colleagues do, but these methods that I'm sharing have accounted for like 20 some billion dollars of profit increases because they're very elegant, they're very powerful, and they use the power of geometry.
Hi guys, this is Paul Gray of Leaders in Business and Investing, and today I'm joined by a truly special guest, Mr. Jay Abraham. Jay, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I hope I can add value.
Oh, definitely. And you already have, as a matter of fact, because when my partner and I started a hedge fund and we were trying to think about how we were going to go about marketing, my partner said, you have to go check out someone named by James Abraham. And I read up on all your resources and it was instrumental to everything that we did. So I can't thank you enough for that.
That's gracious. You are very welcome. And thanks for the acknowledgement.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the fund managers that are listening today are going to get a lot of value of this interview because, you know, Jay, unfortunately, fund managers make great investors, but they don't always make the best business people. So I'm hoping we can answer a lot of questions that a lot of these folks have.
Great. I mean, I told you that it's my pleasure if I can adapt, modify, conform my various methodology or knowledge to their business. It will be my pleasure, and I hope great benefit comes from it.
Excellent. And you know, with that being said, one of the questions that comes to mind is, in your experience, what is the primary cause of business underperformance, and what are some of the useful techniques that you recommend in order to boost performance?
Well, I mean, I have been trained in a number of different disciplines. I want to be very quick, but to appreciate what's a little bit unique about me, I've had the unintended but good fortune of working in over 1,000 industries, not businesses. And when I started, it was an accidental process. I used to be a job transient and I was just jump around and I'd go from one to another, but they were always industries, not the same business. And after about 9 of them, Paul, I realized that people in one industry don't have a clue how other industries operate. Targeting audiences, value propositions, revenue models, access vehicles, how they reclaim sunk cost investments, how they look at profit, how they look at yield, how they basically extend brand or product. And I got to very, very, very quickly borrowing simplistic methodologies and approaches from a couple of industries that were totally different than the industry I was now in, combining them together into hybrids, adding them to those industries, and the businesses exploded. And many of them became household names. But that was the first thing that happened. Then I went on a mission, a crusade, an obsession, a magnificent obsession, trying to learn everything I could about everything I could outside of any given field so that I had this context of enormous expanded understanding. And then quite accidentally, again, then I'll get to my answer, but having context will help. Then I was able to do some really cool things. Early in my career, I helped the Deming organization. Deming was the father of process improvement, optimization, highest and best use theory. And what was really interesting about it was he was the one that went to Japan back in the late 60s when Japan was known as terrible, 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 terrible quality people. And he turned it around and he helped create the Toyotas, the Nissans, Sonys, Mitsubishis, et cetera. And he did it by a simple distinction. He realized that if 100 people in a factory do this, Paul, which seems like you're working on making one part of one assembly, it's not just one function. Within that macro function or process, there's many other ones in terms of manufacturing. There's throughput, there's a downtime that's not planned, there's preventative maintenance that is planned but can be taken care of in different time and effectiveness levels. There's tolerances, certain tolerances are acceptable. Beyond that, it gets rejected. There's scrap. Scrap can be for tolerances or other reasons. There's two or three other things. And he realized that if you figure out who within the performance of this excels at each of these 10 or so elements, 20 or 30% better than the other 80%. And you took what they do, what they know, strategy, discipline, regimen, protocol, and you taught it to the other 80%, but you did that with 8 or 10 different sub processes, you would bring the power of geometry to bear and it would explode up performance. And that's what he did. And I learned that, and I was able to take the same lessons that he used for manufacturing and apply it to revenue. Wherever there was variation, wherever there was either variation or there were elements within a process on the revenue side, I could basically figure out who did it better, where the variation was, how to fix the variation. And I learned how to work on the geometry of a business. Then I got the ability to work with the largest multivariable, I'll be fast on this, I hope it's not boring, the largest multivariable testing organization in the world. And they tested billions of dollars of variables. This is before the internet. They would test different ways of selling, different ways of confronting a prospect, different ways of upselling, reselling, saving a transaction, going back. They would say different ways of marketing, different ad combinations, different, SQs on shelf, where the shelf position, higher, lower, larger quantity, lesser. And the results and the differentiation and the differences were profound. And I got to look at all that. And finally, I got to work with the largest litigation strategic consulting firm in the world. And they had like 150 PhD psychologists and sociologists. And they looked at everything from venue, jury selection, how to depict pain and suffering or how to minimize it graphically, positioning of their claim. And then I worked with 200 experts, most of which didn't come to me for help with their expertise, but I got the ability to distill methodology that had been measured, quantified, and compared in different performance environments. So I learned all these different things that can come together to dramatically multiply the performance of an activity, an opportunity, a market, a salesperson, a sales proposition, a prospect, a distribution channel, an influencer, and it became very, very, very powerful. And from there, I started doing what I do. And now, you know, 40 years later, I've done it around the world and I've done it for thousands of companies and we've been relatively successful, but it's all this understand how to work on the geometry of business and all the different leverage points that exist within the revenue side of the business. I only do revenue side.
Incredible. No, that's great. And you know, to me, Jay, it seems like a lot of fund managers don't really think outside the box. They don't look at other companies and they say to themselves, you know, what could I take from this company that they do so well? And how can I apply that to my own business? And that's what really stood out to me about your teachings.
Yeah, no, it's, well, I learned long ago that most, there's a bit of a fallacy in the concept of best practices, because historically, best practices are the best practices from one or a couple of related industries. And they tend to be the best linear practices that outperform the other linear practices people are doing. If you look at real breakthroughs, they've almost always historically come from outside the industry, you know, because that's where higher performance will come from. And I'll give you some old examples because I don't wanna try to access some of the new technology, but fiber optics, which for years was the defining factor in telecommunication, was not developed for telecommunication. It was developed for aerospace and borrowed to that industry. FedEx built the whole industry by borrowing the hub and spoke check a clearing process that the Federal Reserve Bank used for overnight checks and using it so they could get packages through a hub. Memphis pot process distributed and delivered by 10 a.m. the next morning. Rogaine was, I think, came from pimples, and Viagra was heart, and a ballpoint pen or a roll-on deodorant. One of them came from the other. But I learned long ago and developed long ago a concept called funnel vision as opposed to tunnel vision. Tunnel vision is where people just try to do the best that people in their industry are doing it. And it's a herd mentality. So you can be better, but it's normally an incremental growth. Funnel vision is borrowing success methodologies, approaches, philosophies, strategies, business models, positionings, all kinds of different dynamics from outside an industry where most of your competitors are not even aware of it. And then we sort of evolved it over time and added it to a whole portfolio of methodology and strategic philosophy. Excellent. I hope this isn't too abstract.
No, it's perfect. I think this is going to help a lot of people. And, you know, for those people that are stuck right now in the tunnel vision phase, what can they do to kind of get out of that phase?
Well, unless you're an anomaly, unless you're a force of nature, unless you're quite a remarkable man or woman, the statistical probability that you have come close to optimizing the performance of any facet of your business, I'm staying in my realm, and if that means how you position your fund, how you target your people, how you basically get people investing more, how you get them staying longer, how you get the position out for it, how you deal with everything from opportunity to adversity, the odds of you getting optimal performance out of everybody that works for you is low if you don't just have institutional investors, the odds of you maximizing all the independent advisors out there that could be feeding you and advocating and being your champions are low. The odds of you basically understanding all the breakthroughs available that could be very simplistic and seemingly elegant and understated from somewhere else that could be applied or low. I can go on and on and on and on because that's what I do. But I do it more, I don't really do it in the hedge fund, but everything is universal and translatable.
Excellent. Okay. And, for investment managers that are interested in growing their funds or their businesses, what are typically the three ways that people can do so? I know this is something you touch a lot on with Tony Robbins.
Yeah. No, I taught him that years ago. I've over my career, Paul, about every couple of years, developed different distinctions and then evolved it. And they've all been based on working on the geometry of a business. And early in my career, the first thing we created was the three-way to grow business model, because everybody and their brother Hitchin says, oh, there must be a trillion ways to grow a business. And the truth are, there might be a trillion techniques or tactics, but they're fundamentally three advanced. The basics are real simple. You increase the number of clients, buyers, patients, you increase the size of each transaction and thus the profit it yields. You increase the frequency of purchase or utility, the other ways you can monetize it. And most people spend most of their time on the first, bringing the transaction in. They don't realize same effort or less, the same sunk cost. If you do it right at the point of purchase, there's oftentimes ethical ways to multiply the transaction going in. And if you double the size, you could quadruple the profit because you have fixed expense and servicing it. Number two is if you have the ability to get them to buy more often, you could redouble the yield or the lifetime value of that buyer. Number three, you've got two different areas. Well, you've got active, you got inactive, and you got prospective, and then you got distribution. If you can make active buy longer and get more utility value for other financial services products, if you can make inactive reactivated, if you can make non-purchase monetized for something else ethical and reclaim the sunk cost and time, effort, money, marketing, opportunity cost, that's pretty, pretty powerful. We do lots of things in the other world, but it probably one of them applies to yours, which is sort of fun. Years and years ago, again, by the way, I don't want to do this because it takes too long, but we have a model where we take a hypothetical company with 1,000 buyers spending $100 two times a year to show a wonderful example. So if 1,000 people buying $100 each time, buying it twice a year, it's $200,000 of volume. If you increased all three of those numbers at just 10%, pardon me, then the 1,000 becomes 1,100, the $100 becomes 110, the 2 becomes 2.2. But when you extend it out, it's not 10%, it's 66 2/3. It's 33% higher. People don't understand. You double those numbers, it's 800%. You can work on the geometry of your business and all your people are analytics and et cetera, but I don't think they look at those kind of factors. And I've lived my life learning how to do that in lots of different domains. I don't do hedge funds. I almost did one. And I was excited about it because I had ways of going to all the independent advisors, et cetera. But what I was going to say, and I talk fast, bear with me. One of the universal things we came up with years ago was a realization that the majority of ethical companies in almost any field, and I'm sure hedge funds the same, most likely get 20 to as much as 100% of their buyers, their revenue from either referrals, word of mouth, associations like that. And yet, when you interview a bunch of people from disparate fields who do get a lot of their business from that, and you ask them to stand if they get 20 to 100% of their revenue from that, then you randomly canvas them and say, well, what's the numbers? And if they're small ones, it might be 20%, $500,000, maybe 80%, $4 million, 100%, $20 million. If you say, remain standing after we've done this, if you can honestly say you have in place at least one formalized, systematized, strategically and continuously adhered to referral generating strategy that you and your whole team applies at key intervals, 95% of those people sit down. If you say, do you have two, then 95% of the 5% sit down. If you say three, they all sit down. And because I've worked with 1,000 industries and I very carefully analyzed and examined and explored all the different elements, we found 150 different strategies for generating referrals, some at the point of purchase, some before that, some at convergent points afterwards, some cyclical, some when certain things happen economically or time of the year, some when breakthroughs occur in different categories they invest in. There's ways to get inactive investors to refer. There's ways to get people who don't buy to refer. But people don't understand. The same people that don't aggressively build integrated, multifaceted referral generating systems will spend money on all kinds of other things. I mean, you guys probably don't do it on Facebook, but whether you have expensive salespeople, pre-COVID conferences, things like that, whereas all of that, by and large, unless you're very well known and trusted and you've already got somebody who's got money with you, getting somebody from suspect trust to committed trust to transactional trust to post-transactional comfortable trust to give you more is a long sweep. Whereas a referral generated, in your case, investor, they already know about you. They came from somebody that trusts you. They're ready to invest. They know what the deal is. They may negotiate. They may not. They tend to invest faster, invest more often, invest longer. They're more enjoyable to deal with. By and large, they refer more people and they cost you zero other than whatever, sort of subtle consideration you might ethically be able to do. But most people don't think about things like that. Is that relevant, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we actually learn upselling from you, of course, and we apply that to our own business. And that's We did substantially well and we grew exponentially from that. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And to speak to the referrals, you know, like you said, it's all about your reputation. And that's why it's so important to maintain a quality reputation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's still not at all masterfully utilized. And the it I'm talking about is we've done billions and billions and billions of dollars for regular commercial type enterprises. With strategic alliances, joint ventures, power partnering, I didn't finish the other three ways of growing a business. I'll give those in just a minute. Strategic alliances, power partnerings, joint ventures, co-branding, endorsement deals. And we've made people millions and millions and millions just because we were able to very integratively and strategically harness the trust, the goodwill, the relationship, the access. You guys are all investors. If you look at affinity, the relationship somebody has earned with someone else, it might have taken them years. They might have spent tens of millions of dollars in interaction, facilities, technologies, transactions. Well, let's say they spent $200 million. If you can get them to introduce you, you're getting the leverage off of that. You don't need much yield to be very significant. But we've done things like that in many different forays all over the world. And I don't think your industry does as much as it could. Is this helpful? Because I don't want to go, I'm a poster boy for adult ADD and I can go rogue very easily.
Well, this is excellent. And this is the topic that I resonated with very well when you speak about relational capital and the fact that you consider everyone to be their own hedge fund. And I can't agree more, because a lot of what we do is because of word of mouth and because people speak highly of us.
Yeah, well, I came up with this years ago because I thought it was fascinating. And just to put it in context, I created 25 years ago something called the strategy of preeminence. And it's a philosophical strategy or a strategic philosophy that is designed to elevate you, your business, everything that flows from it, your people, products, et cetera, as being seen in the mind's eye of the target audience as the only viable choice, the most trusted advisor for life if you do it right. And it's got many different facets that sort of, it's a font that flows from it. But, and remind me, because I'm just having an ADD moment. You just got me on to, what was the question?
Relational capital.
Okay. So it is accelerated, enhanced, fortified, and expanded when you have the ability to use someone else to establish that you are in fact the most trusted advisor, that you are in fact the source they need to turn to. But in order to do it, it requires an integrated attitude, which probably with your audience, if they operate with, which I assume integrity and a great ethos, to be preeminent, and there's another facet of it, I'll introduce in just a minute. To be preeminent, you have to first have literally the best interest of your client at stake relative to where your product, service, investment fits into their lives. If you do, you have a moral obligation, you have a motivation, you have an obligation, opportunity, and a responsibility to the extent possible to get them to invest in you and not your competitors. If in fact you have the case for why your or a portion of your portfolio or your fund is in their better interest, whether it's yield, risk, whatever it is, or you're going to take care of it more, whatever the deal is, most people don't understand how to do that. I was going to tell you two other things. You talked about the human hedge fund, and I also didn't finish, and I know I'm going around and around, but if it doesn't work right, you can cut it out or not use it, or you can edit it around. Okay, so back to the three ways to grow a business. It's the first level of being able to work on the geometry of the business. And it gets really interesting because this is where the concept of lifetime value, allowable cost, most people don't look at the different yield dynamics from different sources, different types of buyers, different types of products or service they sell, different offerings that are made. But when you do, you'll see that different categories are worth a lot more or a lot less, both coming in and over time. And until you know what they are worth, you really don't know how much you can afford not to spend, but to invest for the yield they will give you. And it's not one size fits all. It's a very complex thing. With regard to the other three ways to grow a business, before I was going to tell you that, you have these three ways to grow a business. You increase the number of clients, you increase the size of the transaction, and thus the profitability, you increase the frequency they purchase or utility value, other ways that you monetize it. But there's two things you can do. If you have a certain if you have a certain model right now and you find an easier front end model that gets more people started, the more, as long as they're the right quality, the more the start, the more that'll, for more that start and take the first step, the more it'll take the second and third. If you add a more extensive on the back end, even if it only appeals to a small number of the totality, it can double, redouble, redouble again the yield. So you got all kinds of fun things you can do with all this. Now, back at the three ways to grow a business, there are three advanced ways. The first one is you penetrate a new market every year or a niche. The second is you introduce at least one new product or service every year or a niche. The third is you acquire one company. It can be complementary. It can be competitive. I always want to know, what do people buy before, during, after, and instead? The before, if you own that kind of business, can be a preemptive way to get access to a market before they're ready to transact yours, invest if that's the case. During is something else that they would do. I don't know what it would be because I haven't thought about this detail. Next time, if we have it next time, I will do so. But that gives you another scope of either preventative preemptive access. Or so when I got into that, then I got into greatness. And I realized that almost every human being, in my opinion, Paul, is born, with in their DNA, they're born to be great, great in every facet of a life. If they're entrepreneurs or professionals, if they're leaders, if they're managers, if they're analysts, if they're, you can take outside of the business, if they're friends, husbands, lovers, parents, community contributors, and yet the vast majority of them are not. They're mediocre. And when you look at why, it gets really interesting. And I can go into a lot of a discussion, but most people don't understand how to achieve greatness in any aspect of their life, nor do they understand how to get preeminent in any aspect of their life. And I only look mostly at the revenue side, but in preeminence, for example, there's 8 or 9 areas of preeminence. Leadership, entrepreneurship, mission, vision, empathy, value added on my category as it applies to marketing, selling, positioning, any advertising, mavenship, which is raising your stature to more iconic sense. I can't remember the rest, but these are all elements that can be measured, quantified, and geometrically impact the performance of an entity. Now, you talked lastly about the human hedge fund, and I find this cool, but when I share it with most people, maybe your audience will like it because they are hedge funds. But I believe I deal mostly with entrepreneurs and business owners, mostly entrepreneurs. And there's a difference. An entrepreneur is somebody who's really creating an experience and understands the whole dynamic, and he or she's working towards creating this asset that's constantly going to basically evolve and grow and multiply. And it's going to be an environment where everyone's going to grow and develop. And they're really filling a unique void, or they're bringing greater experience or advantage or benefit or enjoyment or whatever the product is to the people. But when you're doing it, you don't realize you are, in my opinion, a human hedge fund. And if you look at all your people, if they're hedge funds, so a hedge fund basically takes they've got a portfolio, which is represented by different asset classes that are put into that portfolio for some strategy. And those asset classes are predicated on two distinct functions, risk and yield, right? And theoretically, your goal is to get, based on the integration of those two facets, get more yield above and beyond what the risk is worth, or whatever you'd say, because I'm not a professional in this. And yet, most entrepreneurs, most leaders, most CEOs don't realize that their life is the equivalent of that. And they are allocating enormous classes of their investable assets. Could be time, opportunity cost, emotion, balance, family. It could be the regular thing they're doing, investment. But they don't even know how much percentage they're doing. They don't know the risk associated. They don't know the yield they're getting. They don't know what mean is. And they don't have a clue in those relative aspects of their business, their life, what alpha. alpha is supposed to look like. So how can you win if you don't know the game you're playing?
Right.
I don't know if that sounds too abstract.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, it makes sense because if you think about it, everybody has the same amount of time during the day. So how you choose to allocate your time, how you choose to allocate your resources, and who you choose to invest in, whether it's your colleagues, your spouse, your friends, that all gives you what you yield.
Yeah, my life, just an undercurrent, my life has been denominated in perpetual experimentation of variability and optionality, because you do something one way, it produces X, you do something another, it can be 2X, you do something in one place, it produces a torrent of results, do it somewhere else, it does not. It's all, you know, I have friends who are decision scientists, and we come together and we talk about decisions, optionality, variability, and understanding how to harness that. I mean, it's amazing that when you understand that so many things perform so much, I mean, I think your audience probably mostly, so many things in the revenue side of a business and probably in the operations, just not what I do. Their performance varies so much because of variables, optionalities, you know, combinations. And when you start analyzing, I mean, I've seen this is in the regular business market. I've seen saying something one way against saying something another way triple yield. We had a furniture store, a huge one, and we tested 33 ways of greeting somebody at the front door, and one of them tripled response. We tested different ways of allaying the resistance or the fear, risk reversal or risk mitigation or is another word for it. It's an investment term, de-risking the transaction for both sides, the seller, the buyer. And we quadrupled results. We've tested saying thing and positioning one way against another and doubled the yield. You may have seen some of my work. I'm lately working on something which is, it sounds hyperbolic and ludicrous, but it's actually understated. And the concept is how to work on taking your business profits beyond exponential. And the first time you say that, people look askance. And the concept behind it is interesting. And I'm throwing all this out because maybe you can distill it, or your people can divide and conquer and find a couple of filaments that make sense to them. So when I got into this, I had created over my career, which has lasted 40 years, 30 or 40 categories of geometric profit growth that would multiply profits in a business by themselves, not all together, by geometric levels with almost no investment and no risk. And I've got 30 of them. And within each one, there's all these levers and fulcrums that I've created and gearings. But I always wondered, what was geometry on geometry on geometry? Now, I'm not even formally educated, and I'm certainly not knowledgeable in mathematics or very sophisticated statistical, although I've been exposed to some very, very cool people that were. So I finally looked it up and found out that mathematically, Paul, there are givens that mathematically you can actually take performance 5 gradients above exponentiation. I'm going to see if I can remember them. Heptation, pentation, octation. I can't remember the other 2 tations, but they're off the chart with the zeros. But the point is, if you can operate beyond exponential in performance, why in the world, and I'm skewing this to the revenue side because that's all I do, why in the world would you want to operate in the incremental zone if everything you could do could be done in the exponential zone for the same time or less, same risk or less, same access to the market or less, same resources or less, same capital or less, same opportunity cost? And that's sort of the essence of what I do. So now you asked me more questions because I didn't let you get a word in anyway.
No, that's phenomenal. I can't agree more, because in my experience, Jay, coming from my industry, we're mostly Excel monkeys and we don't really understand this too much until someone tells us. And that's why when I came across your material, it was such a revelation for me. So to that point, I think it's very important. we were going to touch on it later in the show, but for folks that want to really get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, I mean, if they're serious, they can reach me at jjy@abraham.com. If they're just curious, they can go online and do a Google search. We have hokey webs. I'm a mad scientist, and I'm not into really a lot. We give away 800 or 900 resources. I got lots of stuff all over. I've got books that I think are all over. But yeah, I mean, we have a podcast called The Ultimate Entrepreneur that's got, I don't know, 300 or 400 episodes. But yeah, I got a lot of stuff, and you know, I'm around. So, you know, I show up on people's podcasts occasionally, like yours. I show up occasionally. I'm on Clubhouse now, playing around. So
I heard you last. You're phenomenal.
Yeah, it's and I try. So but yeah, but I hope this gets people thinking.
Wonderful. And you know, before I let you go, I just had a couple more questions that are very concerning right now. One of them is concerning where we are in this low interest rate environment, coming out of this pandemic, and a troubled economy with heavy debt and high unemployment. What opportunities do you see at the moment?
Well, I'm going to answer, but your audience is going to have to upgrade their interpretation, because my work is more with a window of entrepreneurs, 20 to maybe 250 million normally. So when it first started, I identified, and again, I'm trained to see high leverage, low or no risk, high yield, very elegant opportunities, gaps, and what I'll call marketing, selling, profit arbitrage nobody else does. So I found in the very beginning of COVID 5 really cool things that I think still are reasonably available, not as much as before. The first was, now there's every company that's just killing it. There are lots of companies that are doing okay, but they could be stuck, stalled, stagnant, lots of things happening. Depending on the size, there's tons of companies that are open because they are groping, looking for answers as well. And it's a perfect positive storm to structure strategic alliances, joint ventures, endorsement deals, recommended provider deals of all kinds, because people are looking for ancillary, incremental, newfound revenue and growth opportunities. So you can do deals that you didn't used to before with lots of different companies, and I'm generalizing. Similarly, there are many companies that are now sort of breaking even. And again, they're not going to be the huge ones that some of your people look at, but it's still a very real answer. And they're working their hearts out to stay even, lose a little, make a little. If you understand, you know, how to consolidate, you can take them over, you can buy them, buy the assets, consolidate them, and you can acquire some really cool things. We've bought a lot of businesses that were marginal and would sell for very little, and we've given them sometimes 3-4 times what they're worth, but we've paid it out at the equivalent of 50% of the profit we realized for the assets we acquired, whether we acquired, you know, their accounts, whether we acquired their database, whether we acquired their URL, their phone number, their Salesforce, their IP. And so we were paying them. That's why we were able to buy them for no capital. I got started with no capital, and the people that I had to help, Entrepreneur Magazine, Icy Hot, they didn't have any money in the beginning when I started with them. So we had to figure all kinds of ingenious things. The next, which is really interesting, and I think it's changing, but at the last I looked, there were 15 or 20 million people still out of work. And if you look at them, it's bifurcated. The vast majority are low skilled, and I have great empathy for them, but there's nothing I can do for them right now, and it's not relevant to my answer. But a surprising number are super skilled, and they lost their job for one of three things, least of which was incompetency. One was that their role was consolidated and they were extraneous. The second is that their role was no longer needed. The third is they just made too much money and the employer wanted to get rid of them. But before they left that job, they had spent enormous amount of hard won effort, time, conduct, interacting, creating enormous trust, credibility, and access to decision makers, icons, highly desirable people in all facets of the business world, who many people in business would give their left you know what to have access to, and couldn't do it in years of trying or spending a fortune with salespeople or going to conferences. You can find a lot of these people on LinkedIn. It just says available. And if you can win them over to see the integrity, the trust they have of you, your product, service, company, and they're not on a non-compete clause, and you can persuade them, you can get them to make introductions if they believe in you, and in all of a month that could be worth tens of millions of dollars in business you could have never gotten yourself. The next, and it may not be as appropriate for your hedge funds, but there's actually a lot of salespeople that are out of work because they couldn't sell what they were doing anymore, or the demand slowed down. And these people are available to do all the things that I talked about for you, or just go out and open up accounts or set up deals for you. And they're all over the place and not just low skilled. And the last one is what I always called, I mean, there's many more, but these are my answers that are sort of nonlinear. The last one is what I call options trading, but it's not what your people would think of. It's identifying assets and access from other companies that are dormant, underutilized, that could be acquired and monetized and flipped. And I'll give you older examples, just two, but there's tons of them, I'm sure, today. Just my mind is not thinking currently. So many years ago, a colleague of mine moved to Los Angeles area. I live in Los Angeles. He had no business, but he was a good entrepreneur. He identified that the Rose Bowl, the place that they played football, UCLA played football, they did some concerts, was underutilized about 90% of the time. It had huge parking. It had huge exhibit space, but it wasn't being used. And he went to the county and he locked in the rights to use it on the off underutilized days for a flea market, not knowing anything about flea markets. And then he had a provision in his deal that was renewable, but also he could bring out an acceptable partner. As soon as he got it locked up, he found the largest flea market management company, flipped it to them, got a seven-figure front-end payment, and made seven figures just for owning it. And there's tons of stuff out there where you can use a brand, you can use distribution, you can use access, you can use somebody's Salesforce, you can use somebody's, I mean, we have a program I created years ago, and it was for smaller entrepreneurs, and it was called the Unlimited Business Checkbook. And the concept is that whatever you think you are impaired about, Paul, you don't. Somebody else has that asset, that ability, that market. All you have to do is figure out who it is and what it is you've got that they need. I believe you're always the solution to somebody else's problem, or the fulfillment of somebody else's opportunity. I'll give you one simple, and it's not going to be the billions of dollars your people think about, but it's pretty cool. So I used to do a lot of seminars when I started around the world, and I did them in China, Vietnam, Singapore, Italy, everywhere. When I went to China in the beginning, some very nice entrepreneurs, they weren't people that were trying to knock everybody off, because that's who I appealed to, nice people, came to the program. They're very expensive. And a young man came to the mic, and at the end of the program, through translation, said, "What do you do if you're a small entrepreneur and the bank won't lend you money?" And I said, "Well, why don't you tell me what you'd do if you had the money? What would you spend it on?" And he said, "I'm a small localized," this will be the last thing I'll say, you can throw me out. "I'm a small localized motorcycle manufacturer." And I'm thinking, in China, you got a local motorcycle manufacturer because you got probably 100 million population in that city. And if I had the money, I'd go all over Asia and I'd open a factory and hire salespeople, and I'd open offices, and I'd recruit dealers, and we'd sell motorcycles everywhere. And I said, okay, so what's the problem? And he started getting mad. He said, I told you, they won't give you money. I said, you don't need money. All you have to do is realize you're the solution to somebody else's bigger problem. Figure out what it is and you can own it. There's got to be someone in Asia that's not competitive, that's compatible, that has a big factory. They aren't using it all. They have salespeople, they have dealers, and you can partner with them. And that took me a minute and a half. I came back 15 months later. The same guy comes at the end of the next seminar, smiling like the Cheshire cat, Paul. And he said, I did what you said. And I don't remember, because I spend my whole life solving problems, untangling Gordian knots, stuff like that. But he told me, and I said, so what'd you do? He said, I went around Asia. When I got to Kuala Lumpur, I found Asia's largest lawnmower manufacturer. They had a huge factory, a very underutilized second shift. We made a deal. All I had to do was bring the tool and dies. They had the people. I had to train the people and train the salespeople. They had thousands of salespeople and tens of thousands of dealers in our first year together with no money. We both made, I can't remember if it was $10 or $20 million, but somebody already has what you need. You're the solution to their problem. You are the answer to their opportunity. So nobody, I mean, there's no such thing as impaired resources. You can always get someone to provide it if you have the ability to articulate that you have their solution. That's it.
Excellent. And you know, because of that video that you sent us last month, I heard what you said in reference to this. And I thought, you know, last year was the most hedge fund closures in the past decade. So I'm sure there's a lot of talented individuals that could be very helpful to our own fund. So we started reaching out to those folks and we're currently in conversation. So I definitely recommend it to everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, the biggest, we have something called the 9 drivers of exponential growth. And they're things that are so powerful that even if you misexecute, they compensate for you. Strategy, marketing, business model, process, systems, procedures, how you use relationships, how you use capital. But one of them is ideology. If somebody like myself sounds off the wall and makes no sense and sounds totally the antithesis of the more structured MBA training that a lot of you have, then you're right. But I just want to say this without being rude, and it's not big dollars compared to what I think some of your colleagues do, but these methods that I'm sharing have accounted for like 20 some billion dollars of profit increases, because they're very elegant, they're very powerful, and they use the power of geometry. So hopefully that helps, Paul.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we were talking about our friend Anthony Scaramucci earlier. And when he was on the show, he was telling us the way he built his business was during the financial crisis. He knew Citigroup was having trouble with one of their groups that they didn't really want anymore. And he said it was a perfect opportunity for his firm. And he came in.
And I know that story because I know Anthony and I know that story, but he's right. But there's always opportunity to be filled, problems to be solved. And you just have to know how to seize it. And obviously you have to be able strategically to make it work. And that sometimes is a challenge. So you have to have good strategic, critical, and consequential thinking skills as well.
Excellent. And Jay, my last question for you is, you work with so many influential people, just to name a few: Tony Robbins, Damon John from Shark Tank, Anthony Scaramucci, Jordan Belfort, and Brad Lee. What current projects are you working on that we should try to keep track of?
I got really excited about this taking your business profits beyond exponential. And I've spent the last year refining the methodology, and now we're looking, I mean, yeah, it's an open call. I'm looking for businesses with lots of moving parts that are underperforming on the revenue side that are great partners that I can really apply it to. I'm older and I spent most of my time, I was hopelessly curious. So I discovered all kinds of things and I traveled all over the world and taught it to people and did very, very, very significant and rather high paid fixed fee income. And now we're more interested in performance, just if it wins, we win. If it doesn't, we don't. And getting involved with companies that have a lot of moving parts in their revenue system. If you know of anybody, I'm all for it. If you got PE firms that want to talk, I'm all for it. If not, I hope this helped.
Absolutely. Jay, thank you so much for your time today. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on.
My pleasure. It was a privilege. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. We'll talk soon.
Okay.